Hello, thank you for joining me today. How are you? You're listening to My Surrogacy Journey, the podcast. I'm Wes, husband to Michael, co-founder of My Surrogacy Journey and father of two via surrogacy. Today, I'm hosting on my own, which is quite a novelty. I'm quite enjoying it, actually. Today, I'll be talking to three experts all about immigration and when navigating international surrogacy. Thank you for downloading us again. It's great to be back with you. We have a fabulous sponsor for season three podcast. It's Manchester Fertility. They were founded in 1985 and have an exceptional team of fertility doctors, nurses, embryologists, and patient support staff. Manchester Fertility remains one of the leading fertility clinics in the country to date, delivering more than 8,000 babies, which is an amazing amount. Imagine working and helping create 8,000 babies. For intended parents seeking surrogacy support, Manchester Fertility is My Surrogacy Journey's Northern and Midlands Centre of Excellence. We really love working with Manchester Fertility and the team. Offering surrogacy advice and fertility treatment options for gay, bi, queer and trans men and heterosexual singles and couples, helping them to navigate their way through their surrogacy journey. We're talking to the incredible Antonia Felix, Alice Mantle and Natalie Loder from Mishkonda Raya. So hello and welcome, ladies. I'm sure you're going to do a much better job at introducing yourself than I will. So Antonia, why don't we start with you? Give us a quick, what's your name and where you're from?
I'm Antonia. Hello, thanks for having me. And I am a family lawyer and I live in London.
And I'm Alice. I'm also a family lawyer at Mishkonds. I've been there for 10 years and I'm also from Southwest London.
I'm Natalie. I'm an immigration lawyer at Mishkon. I'm from all over the place. Okay. But at the moment I live in London.
Amazing. So thank you for being in the studio with us today. We much prefer having people in person because we get so much of a much more fluid conversation and I think a much better podcast. So I'm really looking forward to this episode. It's all about the impact of immigration and international surrogacy. Now you guys, we've got some experts in the room. So let's start off with really looking at the destinations that are fairly common and talk us through how friendly some of those are from an ease of exit point of view. Who's going to take that one first?
I think that's my jurisdiction.
I love how you both just look straight at Natalie.
So ease of exit, that's a really good point. So a lot of people wouldn't realise at the start of their immigration journey that they have an immigration angle that they need to consider. So the first point to make is that your baby once born can't travel until it has a travel document, so a passport. So there'll be some countries, if you're looking at international surrogacies, where your baby will get a passport just by virtue of being born in that country. And there are other countries where there's no acquisition of citizenship at all. So you will have to wait until, if you're British, until your baby is given a British passport before you'll be able to travel. So commercial surrogacy isn't legal in the UK, so that's why people look internationally to do surrogacies. And some popular destinations that we've seen are the US and Canada, Ukraine, Georgia and Mexico. So for countries like the US and Canada, they have great citizenship laws because if you're born in the US or if you're born in Canada, you have an automatic acquisition of US or Canadian citizenship. So that means your baby born there will get a US or a Canadian passport, and you can probably get it relatively quickly, which means as soon as you've got the passport, you can come home. So if we're thinking about the US, usually you can get your birth certificate about a week after the baby's born, and then you will usually have your US passport about a week later. So you're looking at maybe a 2 to 3 week return to the UK post-birth, wow, which is so fast.
It is super, really fast. I mean, I hadn't heard of it that quick, and I always put a buffer in and I say 4 weeks, but that's just to manage expectation because we all know what IPs are like when they're kind of trying to navigate that.
Well, that's just everything goes very smoothly. As soon as the baby's born, you're putting in that application for the birth certificate. As soon as you've got the birth certificate, you've got the passport application ready and it goes in and you're using the priority services to get everything done. So maybe 4 weeks is more realistic because often you can't name your baby straight away. You might want to have a few days to think about what are we going to call our baby. So yeah, you can't always automatically just go straight for your birth certificate. So there are lots of things which could cause a hiccup in the timeline. And of course, you're dealing with government agencies as well for these documents. So sometimes, you know, it's not always the published time frame that you'll get your documents returned to you. So yeah, I think it's good just to have a buffer. And so I would say anywhere between 2 to 4 weeks to coming home.
And that's, I suppose, if it's very straightforward, mm-hmm. if you know in advance exactly, you know, I speak to a lot of intended parents where there's quite complex immigration statuses. I might not be using the right terminology here, but I kind of know what I mean. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, one might be a British national, one might not, or they might have certain visa status. And I'm assuming all of those elements can impact
That's right. So the US and Canada are popular because of that. You know definitely your baby's going to get a passport from the US or from Canada. But if you're looking somewhere else like Ukraine or Georgia, there's no automatic citizenship. So your baby isn't entitled to a Ukrainian passport, isn't entitled to a Georgian passport. So at that stage, we have to look at if you're a British intended parent, how is your baby going to get a British passport? Because it may be that you can't just automatically give your citizenship to your baby. So it gets very complicated. Or it could be you're not British, but you're living in the UK on a visa of some type. So then you need to think about how we're going to get a passport for our baby from our home country and then get the necessary British visa for our baby in order to come back to the UK. So all of these things will impact your time frame for coming home. And that's why you need to think about immigration right at the start, because you need to know, how are we going to get home? How long is it going to take us? And there's a lot you can do to pre-prepare. But I think if you go into your surrogacy knowing that the end point isn't just the birth of your baby, which of course is the most joyous thing. What's even more joyful is to come home and to be at home and introduce your baby to your family and friends. And that you need to get your immigration in line to be able to achieve.
And that's why we always have Natalie or one of her colleagues in the first meeting, because it's often not something that someone's thought about.
I agree. I totally agree.
And they need to be fully informed so that they can make arrangements on the ground. Mm-hmm. They need to know where they're going to live for however many weeks or months until they can get back to their home in the UK.
Exactly.
And what support they're going to have around them to help them care for their newborn baby.
Exactly. And that's a really good practical point, Alice. So if you are having your baby somewhere where you might be looking at a 3-month wait or maybe even longer to be able to get a passport and come back to the UK, then you might want to think about, you know, where will we comfortably be able to live and where will we be able to afford to live? Also, what's it going to look like in terms of work? So I'm an immigration lawyer, so of course I'm always thinking about immigration, but a visitor status won't always let you work from that country. So if the primary carer is not working, but the second parent is going to have to work, it may be they won't be able to do it from the country where your baby's born without having some kind of employment visa or a visa that allows them to work. So some countries have sort of, you know, digital nomad visas. In some countries, it's really easy to get an employment pass. In other countries, it's almost impossible to get an employment pass. So you need to think about what our work arrangements going to look like. And then who's our support network once we get there? You know, maybe you need to think about, do I need to get a visa for my mum or my dad or my brother and my sister so that they can come out and visit us while we're waiting for the baby's passport to come through and give us support and start to bond with the baby as well.
So we've spoke specifically about immigration and it does absolutely blow my mind because there's so many like variations and so many things that people have to consider. And I think it's absolutely essential in my eyes to make sure you do get really up-to-date immigration advice before you start. But let's talk more specifically about, so let's talk about the US or Canada. If people are thinking about that destination and they've got their mindset on the US as an example, we would always recommend that they work with one of our partners, potentially Ms. Gondorea, to understand what that legal process looks like for the parental order when they return. Yes, there's immigration aside, but they still have to go through a parental order, right?
Yes, they do. And that's, again, when you speak to clients at the beginning, the intended parents at the beginning, and they think that it's going to be easier because they've chosen a destination where there might be the ability to have a pre-birth order, like in America. When they speak to us, we often feel a little bit like we're coming at it from a more negative angle, when actually it's a really exciting time when we have to say, regardless, you've still got to get a parental order in England and you've still got to go through the same process as if you were doing it in another jurisdiction. But obviously it makes it slightly easier if they're working with people in the US agencies and clinics who know how to do it and who have done it a lot. And because it's a very popular destination, it's usually slightly easier to get all the paperwork and to work with the people that they've got in the US as well. But yeah, it doesn't change the fact they still need a parental order here, and the timings are no different either in terms of waiting to get the parental order, which can take 6 to 9 months in England.
No, and I think people underestimate that. And I think at My Surrogacy Journey, we obviously make sure that they get independent legal advice before they start their journey, so they understand exactly what the parameters are. They can get access to immigration advice. For me, it's all about, how do you equip equip them with everything that they need to know so that they're going into this journey with their eyes wide open and understand the impact of every single stage of the journey. That's the ideal, right?
Yeah, and I think it's, as Antonio says, you don't want to kind of be the bearer of bad news and say, well, yes, you've gone to California and you're the child's parent there, but actually you come back home and in England you're not recognised as the legal parent and need a parental order. And similarly with other emerging jurisdictions that might be cheaper than California, people need to understand the risks. And then it's up to them to make their decisions accordingly, as long as people don't go into things kind of blind to those risks.
And I hear quite often, actually, that some people just don't even submit the parental order application.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the impact of that? Because people think there's no impact, but actually, there's quite a significant impact there, isn't there?
I think it's judicially, it's been referred to as a ticking time bomb, because right now, when your child's growing up, they're at school or whatever, it might be fine. You might have your red book, you might have your birth certificate, you might be able to sign them up for schools, nursery, whatever, and not have any issues. You know, God forbid they might have an accident or something, you might need to consent to some medical treatment for them or something. Again, might not be an issue, but could be an issue if the doctors ask, well, do you actually have authority to make these decisions and to give these consents? But also further down the line, if the parents fall out and then there's a battle over who the child's going to live with, who's going to look after them, sometimes it can come up then. Sometimes it can come up with passports. Sometimes it can come up with inheritance. So, you know, it can be a long way in the future that it comes up.
And even pensions, which people obviously don't think about, the more unknown.
Yeah. So I can completely understand how people have gone through these really long, really expensive journeys. And the last thing they want to do is go to court, tick another box, fill in some more paperwork, have another social worker evaluating their circumstance. They just want to live their lives happily with their baby. But it shouldn't actually be an arduous thing to get a parental order. It should be an easy thing that people can be guided through as long as they tick the boxes. And, you know, the court hearings, yes, you're in a court building, but it should be a pleasant experience. The judge, sometimes they, you know, want the babies to come in, they want to have the photo and things. So I think, yes, some people think it's unnecessary. A, it's not unnecessary, and B, it shouldn't be unpleasant. No,
this was not a kind of a question that anyone had prepared for, but look at that answer, straight to it, like one after another, I was waiting for them, bing, 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 there we go. Everything I was expecting you to say, there we go.
Yeah, and I think it is difficult because in meetings, the clients ask us that, you know, they say exactly what you've just said. And obviously this baby is yours and you come home and it's always going to be yours and you're caring for it. So we have to be, as lawyers, quite careful that we don't just come at it legalistically, but also, you know, from a personal point of view, which is, we really advise you do this because in the long run you'll be pleased. But equally, of course, that baby's yours and no one's saying it's not. Because I think some people arrive at this point having been through a very emotional journey and they don't even want to think about the fact that their baby might not legally be theirs. But I also think later down the line, if when your baby's grown up and they ask questions, there have been recent cases where a parental order has been made out of time, because you usually do it within 6 months of the birth of the baby, because that child actually wanted to have that identity. And you can't necessarily think about that before your baby's even been born, but the reality is you just don't know what's going to happen. And so in a way it's easier to do earlier rather than worry about it. And the other thing is that, you know, it's such a changing landscape and people now understand so much more about surrogacy, which is brilliant, and you know, we're all here today because of that. But some people don't understand it or have just a complete lack of awareness. And I know you guys have spoken about this before, but you know, in hospitals and things, you might have that one doctor, that one nurse who doesn't really know about surrogacy and will be asking questions, and it might be 1 in 1,000, but I suppose it's just trying to avoid that happening to you at a time when you're not going to be wanting to be worried about explaining how your baby was born.
No, I totally agree. And I think when you have been on that journey, you've done an international journey, if this one last thing is just to get your PO, just to give you that kind of sense of security, then there's no grey area. There's nothing to be worried about. No one's going to come knocking on your door. It doesn't make sense to me why people wouldn't just do this last piece when you've done so many pieces. One more is going to make that much difference.
I think it feels overwhelming, doesn't it? When you're, if we speak to them, which is brilliant if we do, and you help us with that, if you know, because the people that you work with, that's what you recommend. But if we speak to them at the very start of the journey, you're talking about possibly 9-12 months before the baby will even be born, and then another kind of 6 weeks to wait before you could do it, and then possibly another 6 to 9 months. And I think the timings can be quite overwhelming for people.
Yeah, sure.
And I think some jurisdictions, you're named already on the birth certificate. So the mother on the birth or the father on the birth certificate are the intended parents. So people just don't realise the importance of it because they think I've got a birth certificate that shows my name, that shows I am the parent of this baby. Why do I need to do anything more? That's where a lot of people stumble because they just think, well, I've got the documentation that proves it already, but the law is complex and that document in itself is not enough. And the passport office also, you know, when you apply for your passport, they will say, we need evidence that you've submitted your parental order or if your parental order has been granted, we need to see that. So if you don't submit that parental order, you won't get your passport. You won't get it.
I mean, you're just asking for trouble, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So why do we think that most of your clients do the US? Is it because it's such a slick process? Is it because it's a well-trodden path? The exit process is relatively straightforward. I'm answering all of the questions here.
There's nothing for us to say.
No, I think it is. It's a known entity, isn't it? It's that people have heard stories. They've read it's, you know, even celebrities or people that they read about have done it possibly in the US. So I think it's something that they can identify with and they feel it's possibly safer because it's a well-trodden path, so they feel like there'll be less risk involved just in the way everything's approached and the way the agreements with the surrogates are made as opposed to some countries. But obviously then there's the cost element to it.
Yeah, I think because it is a well-trodden path, I think people are less concerned about exploitation of the surrogates as well. Mm-hmm. And they feel that there are those safeguards in place. I think the language is also an issue. You know, if you're going to be looking after your baby, even if it's just for a few weeks in another country, I mean, life with a newborn is enough without having to navigate a country where you don't speak the language. Political stability as well. Obviously, you know, things have been going on in the US, particularly with reproductive healthcare, etc. But relative to other jurisdictions that have been popular for surrogacy, it is potentially more stable, which is really important for people on their surrogacy journey, both when their surrogate's pregnant, but also thinking about the storage of their embryos, for example.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And now I know my surrogacy journey, we talk about our Mexico City program. I just wondered if you had any views on Mexico generally.
For me.
I think that's for you, Natalie.
So, you know, it's a relatively new pathway, I think, Mexico City. But what we know is that from an exit perspective, it's quite similar to the US in that a baby born in Mexico has automatic acquisition of Mexican citizenship. I think the process for getting the passport is much longer than the process for the US and Canada. And what we're hearing is around sort of 3 months or so, but it could be longer for a Mexican passport. So intended parents may want to have a dual approach whereby they submit an application for a British passport and submit the application for a Mexican passport and see which one comes first. But, you know, if there is an automatic acquisition of British citizenship for the baby born in Mexico and you do the British passport from abroad, that won't necessarily be a fast application. So you may still get your Mexican passport before the British passport. And the reason why it takes so long to get the British passport when you submit it from abroad is because the passport office in the UK has to have safeguarding checks in place. So they need to make sure that all the sort of legal requirements for the surrogacy have been met. They need to establish identity. Are you the intended parents? Is the baby you're making that application for actually the baby that was born to you by way of surrogacy? So there are lots of things they need to check. It's to prevent child trafficking. So it's there for the benefit of everybody. They're not saying that we think you're suspicious, not at all, but they have got these internal policies that they need to meet. They need to reach out to external agencies to get verifications. And that's where these things start to become very protracted. And I think, although I don't know for certain, but I think there's also a triaging system. So they're always going to be reactive where there is a child in danger, and that application will go ahead of a child that's not in danger. So if, for instance, they have got a lot of applications from, say, surrogacies which have taken place in Ukraine, and it's not safe to be in Ukraine because of the war, then those applications will be prioritised over countries that are more stable.
Yeah. And I think from memory, there's on their website, there's quite an exhaustive list of documentation that has to be provided, which would then allow them to be eligible to apply for a British passport when in country. I'm hearing as well, let's talk about ETDs, so an emergency travel document. Mm-hmm. So I hear that a lot of people are expecting to get ETDs and are using that as their preferred option. It's their plan A, if you like. Yeah. And I'm hearing that more and more. And I know from my surgery, we have particularly with our Mexico City program, have been working with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and trying to understand whether that's a viable option. And I was being given very clear guidance from them that an ETD is for exceptional circumstances only and should not be used for a planned event. Now, Natalie, ladies, please give me some, oh, they're both looking at Natalie here. Just give us a bit of guidance on that, because I think some people are being told, maybe by agencies in the country or in the jurisdiction, that they can just get an ETD. What's your view on that?
Yeah, we've got to myth bust this.
Absolutely.
So emergency travel documents are just that. They are emergency travel documents for emergency situations. So I think where this idea that any baby born by way of surrogacy is entitled to an ETD has come about because during the COVID pandemic, the UK government changed their policy and exceptionally allowed surrogate babies to be granted ETDs because there was a complete shutdown of passport issuance in the countries where they were born. So the only way to be able to come back to the UK would be with an emergency travel document, because they wanted all the babies to be able to come back to the UK as quickly as possible. So once they get back to the UK, they would then apply for a full British passport once they were back in the UK. But now that the COVID pandemic is over, the ETD for a baby born by way of surrogacy is not just a given. You have to be able to show that there is an emergency situation which warrants it. It's still not that easy to do. So an emergency situation could be if, God forbid, your baby is born with a health issue and it's not possible for that baby to be treated in the country where it was born, and there's a real requirement to bring the baby back to the UK as quickly as possible. That could be an emergency situation. It could be if your baby is born in Ukraine and there's a significant risk to life or to health. If you don't come back quickly, then in that circumstance, perhaps an ETD will be granted. But I think a planned event in a country which is relatively stable, that is not going to warrant an ETD.
So I think people shouldn't, I think the overwhelming advice here is do not rely on an ETD, because it's very unlikely that you're going to get an ETD if you're thinking that's your plan A. Mm-hmm. You need to follow the process. You can't use an ETD to circumnavigate around the normal exit process.
No, you need to go into it with your eyes wide open. So if you're being told you can definitely get an ETD for your baby, do not rely on that. It may be possible to get an ETD in a very narrow set of circumstances, but certainly not for every baby born by way of surrogacy.
So you heard it first here. Do not rely on an ETD. Amazing. Let's just talk about some of the more obscure destinations that we hear popping up. So let me just reel a few of these off. Mombasa, Turkmenistan, Ghana. Now, I've lived in Turkmenistan for a really short period of time for work, and it's not one of those places that automatically make me feel like surrogacy is going to be an amazing destination for that. So just give me your views on Mombasa, Turkmenistan and Ghana.
On the one hand, from a family law perspective, as we've said, regardless of where you have your baby and regardless of what the legal position is there, when you come back to the UK, you still have to apply for a parental order. And as long as you can tick all the boxes and fulfill all the requirements, then the court isn't going to say, oh, you went to this country.
They don't discriminate on destination.
No, exactly. But put that to one side, you obviously have to think about what's the law there on surrogacy. Is surrogacy recognised, or is it just kind of under the carpet? The practical issues when you have your baby, you know, where are you going to live? Is it safe, secure? Can you speak the language? How are your support network going to be there? Also, obviously, we all understand how desperate people are to have babies, but ensuring that you're comfortable with the ethical situation there and that you're comfortable that the surrogates aren't being exploited and that everything is done in a way that you will be comfortable with now and you'll be comfortable with your child knowing was how they came into the world. And unfortunately, there are a lot of jurisdictions that become very popular. So who knows, one of those countries might be the next kind of top destination. But then it becomes too popular. There is an awful case or an instance of exploitation or more. And then those countries can be shut down. And that's obviously happened with India, with Thailand, and most recently with Georgia.
Absolutely. That's exactly what's happened with Georgia, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's been seen that it's becoming an industry. the Georgian government don't like it and they're now closing it down to international intended parents.
Yeah, so it's one of those risks. And so I think that's why the Mexico City pathway is such a good thing, is because a lot of people can't afford the US. And, you know, it is hugely expensive for one child, let alone if you want to have siblings. So having an alternative where you know, where you're comfortable that everything is legitimate, no one's being exploited, you know, everything feels safe, is really, really important, because otherwise people can be tempted to go to all these different countries. And you know what? Their journey might be fine, but it might not.
It is. And it's about that risk, isn't it? It's about how much risk are you willing to accept?
Mm. Yeah. And it's working with trusted advisors, essentially, like you know, My Surrogacy Journey and the right lawyers and the right agencies. And if they've done the research and they're working with people that they know, that they trust, and that they understand the answers to their particular questions, because, you know, everyone has something that is more important to them, possibly, and depending on what relationship they want to have with the surrogate and the agency and getting all the documents, etc. So if Mexico City is going to offer that sort of pathway where they can ask questions and have the answers and not feel it's a process that they can't have an input into, then I think that's a really good thing.
I agree. And I talk to intended parents a lot, and the things I say to them when they're asking me about international destinations, I say there's no perfect destination for surrogacy. It doesn't exist, but there's an ideal destination for them. And it's about, and inevitably there's going to be some compromise along the way with a destination. Is it budget? Is it time frame? There's always some kind of, you know, the UK is, you know, 2 year wait time, but the US is 250K. It's like, how do you navigate through all of those different pathways and know which one's right for you? And I think it's through working through an organisation, letting people help you understand what the pros and cons are to each destination, and then really finding out what works for you.
Yeah, and like, people might have family in certain jurisdictions or speak a particular language, or as Natalie said, it might be that one or both of the parents have to work during the period that they're going to be confined in that country with their newborn, and therefore they need to think about that. So it's this matrix of lots of different factors and then choosing what's the right destination for the particular family.
But I think it's a really big decision.
Yeah, and absolutely. Talking to people who have been through the journey, if you can find them,
yeah,
or being put in touch with people, because then you can ask questions where someone has sort of given you the real time examples of, oh, we did this, have you tried this? And I think that gets you thinking, so that you're then asking the people who are helping you the right questions as well.
It is. I think sometimes you don't know what the right questions are to ask. You don't know what you don't know. I say this all the time.
Exactly.
We say it, but it's like, you genuinely don't, unless you... I do struggle sometimes with these people who don't want to take the advice. There's lots of advice and people support you there now, but they're hell-bent on going on a destination that they think is the right destination for them, and they don't take immigration advice. They don't typically get legal advice before they go, and these are the ones that, you know, turn upon your door in trouble because they've got themselves into a situation which was absolutely really avoidable.
Exactly.
Just to say, from an immigration perspective, there will always be a route back to the UK, so regardless of the destination that you choose, it's just, how long are you going to stay there? How long do you want to stay there post-birth? You know, how well are you supported in that country to stay there for a long time if the UK passport or if the UK immigration process is going to take a long time? You really, really need to think about those things, because once you get the baby, you want to enjoy your time as new parents with your newborn baby. You don't want to be worrying constantly about, how many days until I get home? How are we going to afford being here? Who's going to help me look after this baby? You know, they're not the questions you want to have coming up after your baby's been born.
But if you get all of the right advice at the beginning, you're going to know which is the most efficient and effective way to exit and get where you need to be, where, rather than kind of making mistakes and then realizing that you're only having to deal with now the situation you're in, and there's very little you can do about it.
Yeah, exactly. It gives you options. But I think also the world's changed so much recently. No one would have foreseen the COVID pandemic. Now we're all more cautious that you have to choose these jurisdictions, and also think about what might happen, even if it seems completely unlikely, because we still had intended parents in America just as COVID hit and the borders were shut down, stuck in America. And, you know, it all ended up fine in the end. As Natalie says, everyone gets home in the end. But it's kind of thinking about all the options and also thinking about them early enough so that when you're closer to the due date and you've got your little baby, you're not having to think about it.
No, totally, totally. And I think, you know, we didn't foresee Georgia potentially closing down, and we're hearing lots of rumblings about Colombia. You know, there's lots happening in you know, in the global surrogacy world. There's lots of rumblings about stuff happening. So being in a destination that is, you know, more of a well-trodden path and has a more of a process, then just must give you more comfort around it, you know, the stability of it.
Exactly.
I think so. And I think, you know, talking about all those different countries, that's the law on surrogacy differs so greatly across different countries. You know, even just across in mainland Europe, it's so different in certain countries than it is here. And so just that understanding for people that, I mean, a lot of people before they start on their journeys don't even know what the law is here, understandably, let alone what it is in various different jurisdictions. But there is such a disparity.
It is. And look at the US and how the laws vary by state.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, when we look at, when we're looking with the intended parents about what's the best state for them, there's so many things you've got to consider. Their marital status, whether it's donor gamete. There's so many different elements to consider. I mean, that's in the US, which is the, you know, probably the safest place to do surrogacy in the world.
Exactly. Yeah. And now with abortion rights as well, the legal landscape A differs and B is constantly changing.
Mm-hmm. It is. Let's talk about the lovely topic of domicile status. Now, this comes up really often, and we know it's part of the parental order process. You know, they have to have domicile status to be able to apply for a PO. But I get a lot of people, particularly who are not British nationals, asking whether they would, you know, qualify for domicile status. Now, I totally accept that it's not that black and white, and it's very not woolly. That's how I interpret it.
Yeah, I think it's not something you can give a quick, simple answer.
Correct.
To.
That's a
I
good
think.
Point.
And none of us want to get too kind of technical and legal. But it is a technical legal concept. And so you have to look. So there are three different types of domicile. There's domicile of origin, there's domicile of choice, and the domicile of dependency.
I'm loving this. Keep going.
Everyone starts off with a domicile of origin, which they get from their father, if their parents are married, or from their mother, generally speaking. And you revert back to this domicile of origin whenever you lose your domicile of choice, or if you lose your domicile of choice. So it's really important, your domicile of origin. Your domicile of dependency is your parents' domicile, if that changes whilst you're a minor. And then you can acquire a domicile of choice in place of your domicile of origin. If you move somewhere and you have an intention to remain there indefinitely or permanently. And people talk about your domicile of origin being quite sticky. So it's quite hard to lose that and to acquire a domicile of choice. So it's not as simple as somebody saying, well, yeah, I live in the UK and yeah, I really want a parental order. So yeah, I'm domiciled here. I intend to stay here. No, that won't fly. And the courts look at this question in detail. And lots of the factors for getting a parental order, the courts have interpreted these creatively and found ways around it, because ultimately, they want to be able to grant the parental order if it's in the interests of the child. But a bit like the surrogate's consent, domicile isn't something that the court's kind of finding a way around. You currently, one of the applicants has to be domiciled in the UK, Channel Islands or Isle of Man at the time of the application. So yeah, looking at your domicile of choice, if, for example, somebody previously had a different domicile, you'd have to consider it quite early on, get the legal advice, and you'd look at loads of factors. And none of these are necessary or sufficient, but they are just factors you would look at. So things like citizenship or immigration status, property here. A weird one is if they've got a burial plot, because if you plan to live somewhere indefinitely, then you plan to die there. Culture, if you've bought furniture for your house, you know, it really can be very fact specific. And on the culture point, there was a reported case in 2011 where there was an Israeli couple who got a parental order, and there was a decision made on whether they were domiciled here. And there were various factors, the furniture one came up, but also the culture. And actually, they were a gay couple, and when they had come out, they'd been estranged from their families, and they'd faced bullying. They were in the military, they'd faced bullying from that, and kind of societally weren't accepted. And that was one of the things that they used as evidence to say, no, we've moved here and we do intend on living here forever because we're not kind of welcome and valued, and our family isn't valued where we're from. So yeah, you're right. It's a difficult question, and you need to have a very full and frank conversation with somebody if it isn't straightforward.
I mean, I never give advice on domicile. I talk about domicile status and it's a requirement, but I always say, you need to speak to your legal team, or you need to speak to a lawyer to help to let them help you understand whether you meet the criteria for having domicile status. And just as you just very eloquently described to me, that is exactly why. I think it is quite a broad...
It is, and it can be easier, maybe is not the right word, but if you're a couple and not a single applicant, then you can rely on one of them. And sometimes one of the intended parents has a slightly easier journey in terms of domicile. So you can, you know, go with that. And so you can often try and work around it, but it's definitely complicated.
Yes, I can absolutely see that. Now, let's talk about habitual residency, because in the Law Commission, they're looking to... Dilute, is that the criteria? Would that be a fair assumption that they're looking to kind of change the requirements so that it would be domicile or habitually resident? Is that right?
Yes, and that's an easier way of getting around it possibly, because it's less legal concept, more about the sort of the real time. Where are you living? Where's your centre of interest? Where do you where do you work? Where do you go to the doctor? Where do you get your hair done? All those kind of questions. So like, where is your life now, rather than necessarily looking at more of the detail that Alice has just given. So it will be hopefully easier for people, because I would say in our experience with our clients, often the one kind of hiccup along the way is domicile in terms of whether they can get a parental order or not. And I think a lot of them would pass the habitual residence test, as it were. And that will hopefully mean that more people can get a parental order if it comes in.
It does. And I think and I think that's great on one side. But I also think that that would potentially open domestic surrogacy up to a community of people that wouldn't necessarily have met the criteria, because they can't prove domicile status. They might have lived in France, or they might be French, German, Spanish, where they in their home country they don't have a domestic program, and now can much easier demonstrate, you know, habitual residency. Do you foresee that being a potential?
Absolutely. Yeah. It really, and I think keeping both is really important, because it might be that somebody's domiciled somewhere else, but they're habitually resident here. And then they, of course, want a parental order for their child, because they may have lived here for 10, 20 years, but not tick the domicile box. But then it's good to keep the alternative, because similarly, somebody could be domiciled here, but they could live somewhere else for work, for example. And again, they could have lived somewhere else for work for a decade, but they still want their parental order to ensure that, for example, inheritance rights here and things like that. So there are alternatives if people, you know, with the law as it currently stands, requiring domicile or of one or both of the applicants, there, if people can't fulfill that criteria, then there are alternatives that they can consider to regulate the parentage, but none of them are as satisfactory as a parental order.
And I think, as you said, Antonia, like, we don't know whether that's going to change. I mean, that's what the Law Commission are proposing, but until that gets through, we don't know whether that's going to change.
Or how long?
Absolutely. I've kind of been blown away by some of the responses. It's been so interesting listening to, you know, just some of the language, the terminology. It's been really interesting. But like, what are your like nuggets or like number one tips of how you're going to help manage an international journey more efficiently? Natalie, let's start with you.
I think having a timetable, like right at the beginning, and having an idea about what documents you need at what stage. There's a lot you can do before your baby is born to make sure once your baby's born, you can give your baby your full attention rather than give your lawyers your full attention. The other thing is making sure you've had all of the advice and you understand it before you start your journey. Of course, we're willing to come in at any point in anyone's journey because they need that information. They need it, whether it's at the beginning or whether you're right at the end and you've got your baby and you suddenly realise, actually, I didn't realise there were legal requirements. I didn't realise there was an immigration angle. I didn't know about parental orders, or I didn't know enough about it. And now I need to know. Of course, we can step in at that stage. But to have the smoothest journey, just make sure you're armed with knowledge right at the beginning. And there's so much you can do to pre-plan so that once you've got your baby, you can just completely focus on your baby and not worry too much about your lawyers, who will then just have everything in hand and be able to do everything for you.
Amazing. Alice?
I completely agree with all of that. I think maybe it's helpful to think of it in kind of categories. So kind of legal and practical being the first two, which we've kind of covered quite extensively, but then also psychological, for want of a better term. So thinking about not just now, not just how you'll get the baby and how you get the baby home, but in 10, 20, 30 years time, how your child's story and making sure that you will be comfortable with how they were brought into the world and they will be comfortable with the knowledge that they have about their journey.
I think that's really good, actually, because I think when you're on a journey, you're always in the here and now, and you're often not thinking beyond that. And I think thinking about, you know, the impact of your child later in life, I think is a really, really key and important one.
I mean, they've covered everything, but yeah.
I know, that's a bit, not very good going last.
Knowledge is power is all I would say, and ask questions. And I know you say you don't know what you don't know, which is completely right. But I think the more questions you ask, the more questions you think of. And, you know, knowledge being power, just, and feeding into what Alice said, it helps you then form the longer term view as well. So it's kind of short term, long term, and just really make sure it's the right decision for you and your family. Whatever that looks like.
It is. And I'll throw one in here. I think it's about surrounding yourself with this support structure, this scaffolding that's going to help you be successful on your journey. Because I think everyone sets out and wants to be successful. And how are you going to achieve success? By kind of making sure you get the right team and the right support around you. And that's around immigration. That's around lawyers. You know, build that team is kind of my advice. Listen to that. Listen to us. We could go on all day. Look, ladies, I've really, really enjoyed this session. It's been really super informative. I think there's a lot of information in there. And I think the listener is going to be really quiet. I think they're going to need to take the time and listen to this, because there's some really complex stuff in there, particularly immigration, particularly around domicile. And I think it's really, really useful stuff. So thank you very much for your time today. As ever, it's a pleasure to meet you in person and see you again. But thank you very much.
Thanks
for having us.
Wow, that was such a really informative session. I'm so glad we decided to tackle this topic. I get so many calls from intended parents just really not understanding their immigration status and how that's going to impact their journey. So there's lots of takeaways from today, you know, particularly all of the elements that Natalie talked about with regards to immigration. Alice spoke really eloquently about domicile status and what that means. And Anthony was really kind of giving some key messages around how you should approach your surrogacy journey. So I think you're going to find it really useful.
If you want to find out more about My Surrogacy Journey and our completely unique international membership and UK membership, then please head over to our website, www.mysurrogacyjourney.com, or find us over on Instagram at official My Surrogacy Journey. If you like this episode, then please subscribe to the series, and we will have another episode coming out next week. Thanks for listening. Wes has been your My Surrogacy Journey podcast host.
I was about to do that line. Thank you for listening. I've been your My Surrogacy Journey podcast host. Goodbye.